Fort Stewart has nearly 280,000 acres of land dedicated to training the armored component forces of America's Contingency Corps, but it's also dedicated to environmental conservation and restoration. Fort Stewart has a department dedicated to managing the land to meet the needs of combat training and preserving the natural spaces. I'm Jason Hull, and today's Marne Report will be a little bit different. We're getting out of the studio and touring our longleaf pine forest and grasslands with its ephemeral wetlands. We'll be accompanying biologist Larry Carlisle, the DPW Fish and Wildlife Branch Chief. He's a self-described birder, and this is an environment perfect for his birdwatching hobby. He loves it here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Man, I'm horrible with names until we remember
what
it was.
Jason.
I can identify hundreds of birds by their song, and I remember their names, but it's a different situation when it comes to people. Because I really do love birding. I mean, I'm kind of birding all the time. We're having this conversation, but I'm still birding. When we're outside, you know, I'm listening, and we're driving. I notice birds flying up off the roads, and yeah, I was actually president of the Georgia Ornithological Society for a couple of terms a few years ago. So I'm still highly involved with the society.
There are lots of birds in this habitat too. So right now we've got a white-eyed vireo singing. There's an American crow. We also heard a tufted titmouse a little earlier. Pine warbler was over here. I hear Carolina chickadee.
The rubber ducky. The whistling one was a screech owl imitation, and little birds hate owls because they, I guess, know what they can do to them. So they usually fuss when you do that.
So you made their anxiety go up,
yeah.
Sounding like a predator.
Right. Brown-headed nuthatches always start squeaking a lot, doing that kind of chattering call.
Fort Stewart includes one of the most diverse ecosystems in the world, full of rare plants and animals, a large number of which are threatened or endangered species.
Longleaf pine wiregrass habitats, they even rival tropical rainforest as far as the number of species per square meter. So that's incredible, and it's just because of the, and if you had a closed canopy and everything got shaded out, you would not see that kind of diversity. I just love it. It's gorgeous to me.
So this is very typical of a frosted flatwood salamander pond on the coastal plain of Georgia. There are lots of hat pins. That's what this plant is called here, a hat pin. Resembles the old hat pins that ladies used to wear in their fancy hats. So it is a ephemeral pond. You can see that it has cypress trees in it, which indicates that it's very wet. And just the plants that I just mentioned are also closely associated with wetlands. And so when we began to get, you know, some more rain later in the season, late fall, early winter, this pond will begin to flood. And at that point, the salamanders will come out of the crayfish burrows or old root channels or what have you, that they're just out here in the upland landscapes, and migrate to the pond and lay eggs. So it doesn't look like a pond, but that's what we call it. It's a breeding pond for frosted flatwood salamanders.
It's important to know that these ecosystems are actually dependent on fires to ignite the pine needles and the wiregrasses that clear the shrubs and competing hardwoods, so its unique flora and fauna can flourish. the ephemeral ponds where the amphibians make their home, cycles between flooding and drying out, depending on the season or the weather.
We try to burn these units at least once every 3 years, preferably during the growing season. We really want it to burn across that pond to make sure that it stays nice and open to provide all that great native vegetation in the basin of the pond. Because the salamanders seem to really like to lay their eggs under these sedge plants that are growing in and around that pond. And the frosted comes from the fact that it's kind of a grayish salamander with little white flecks all over, so it looks like it's been frosted.
As we depart the wetlands on the east side of the base, Carlisle describes the good news he received as I walked into his office today. It's about their work to expand the rare salamander populations.
Our population is more diverse than, there's only two other extant populations, one at St. Mark's and one at Apalachicola National Forest. So widely separated, right?
And bottlenecking being the reduction of genetic diversity.
Yeah, just because you have fewer breeding adults, so then that results in inbreeding.
You discovered that's not a problem for the first salamanders here?
Well, he's saying that our population is more genetically diverse by far than those other two populations. We've been really concerned about it because back in the late 90s and the early 2000s, we went through kind of a severe drought. And salamanders, of course, got to have water. These animals are late fall, early winter breeders. So they live underground most of the time, except when it's time for them to breed. And they come up from underground during late fall, early winter precipitation events that dump a lot of water and fill those ponds up. And they move across the landscape to the margins of those ponds and lay their eggs on the ground under clumps of wiregrass and on dry land. But then as it continues to rain, it inundates the eggs and they're able to begin to develop. And then hopefully remain flooded until they can hatch so that the larvae can grow and then metamorphose before the pond dries out.
What's the next stop?
We're just going to head out west and have a look at the eagle nest and hopefully call up a red-cockaded woodpecker. We've driven by some red-cockaded woodpecker sites already, which I hope you didn't even notice.
Did not notice.
Good. That's the whole point. That's the whole point.
As we travel west and the land rises some, he describes the importance of the prescribed burns, both for the soldiers' combat training and the land's natural ecosystems.
The marine dune system that runs kind of north-south along Fort Stewart here, back when the ocean was up this far. Yeah, we're about 90 feet above sea level here versus pretty close to sea level down at the Flatwood Salamander Pond.
This is sand's about as hard to drive through as the mud.
Yeah, you can get stuck in the sand too. But at least you don't get your feet wet when you have to pull a winch cable. European settlers came, and then European settlers, I mean, and you can read some of their early accounts, they talk about the vast savanna. One reason savanna is named savanna of grassy plains that's sparsely forested with longleaf pine. And that was because of the frequent fire that occurred here. Naturally, lightning caused fire.
So you see this tall, thin grass where the blooming stalks, flowering stalks are kind of splayed out like that.
Yeah.
That's wiregrass there. See, it's really dense with wiregrass here. This actually is a wiregrass restoration site. We planted that wiregrass because it's also an old field. It was an agricultural field before Fort Stewart became Fort Stewart. So we try to put it back out there wherever it makes sense to do it. We do about 200 acres a year of that. It's got to be burned during the growing season.
in order to bloom and produce viable seed. And these habitats recover very quickly, right? I mean, that wire grass will be green and an inch long within a week after the fire. When there was a lightning strike, it would burn for thousands of acres. Right? But today, there are lots of roads across the landscape. And so if there is a natural fire from a lightning strike, it will burn to the nearest road or the biggest river system and generally go out. But that kind of works in our favor when you're doing prescribed burns, because you want to make sure that you contain the fire such that it doesn't get out of the area where there are no soldiers or material and equipment. So you do it mainly for the sake of training habitat, because soldiers need to have a decent line of sight when they're out in the field training. And if it's all choked up, like, see, this never gets burned here, and you can't see through that. But some of the places that we're going to go to out in the field where the training does occur, you have long vistas you can see for hundreds and hundreds of yards through the woods. So that's the sort of habitat that is required by the listed species that are here. And it's also required by the Army to do effective training, at least the kind of training that we do on Fort Stewart.
Every soldier stationed in the southeast United States is familiar with the endangered red-cockaded woodpecker, as well as the restrictions imposed on military land use as a result. But thanks to the prescribed burn program and the efforts to replenish the population by the Fort Stewart team, these woodpeckers here are a big success story. They've been giving theirs away.
Yeah, the red-cockaded is endangered still. Fort Stewart has been involved in the translocation effort since, I want to say it was 1996. We realized unless we translocated some birds to sort of prop up smaller populations, they were probably going to wink out. There was a decision made on what could be a donor population, and that would be a population that had 100 pairs of woodpeckers or more. And a eligible recipient would be a population that had fewer than 30 pairs. Because the research had shown that once you get to about 30, you have a better chance of that population maintaining and sustaining itself and being able to make enough young of the year every year to help populate new unoccupied sites within that small population. And so we've been doing that, like I said, for 30 years now, essentially. So we're going to do our first one in about mid-August. And those birds are going to go to the Babcock Wildlife Management Area in Florida. And then we'll also set one up for the Sproul Wildlife Management Area in Georgia. And then we're also going to do one for a population that's going to be a jump-started population. That is, there are no woodpeckers there now. There are some very close by at Fort Moore and also on some private property. But those birds are going to go to the Broken Arrow Plantation is what it's called. It's like a quail hunting plantation, but they've got lovely habitat. They burn it all the time. It's just gorgeous. So, over the years, Fort Stewart has donated, I guess we're right at 460 birds since 1996 to other populations. We usually do between 20 and 30 birds every year. If you can count on 60% success for that, and that's generally what we see, that's the average, some of it much higher than that. For example, last year we sent the first birds to Sproul Bluff. We sent 6 birds up there. 5 of them were there during the breeding season this year, and they bred and they produced chicks, so they're already on their way, and they're going to come get another slug of birds this year. So that's a fully successful. They've been working hard on the habitat. That's a Georgia Department of Natural Resources property. They've been doing a lot of burning, thinning, planting a longleaf up there, so a real success story. And that's not the only place they've done it. We've done it at another WMA down in southwestern Georgia. That also has been successful. And Fort Stewart has sent birds to the Talladega National Forest in Alabama, to the Enon Sehoy Plantation in Alabama, to Camp Blanding in Florida,
to the Picayune Strand Wildlife Management Area in South Florida. So Fort Stewart birds are all over the southeast.
Throughout our tour, we hear distant booming sounds of artillery and tank fire. So I ask, what does the presence of military training and explosions have on the ecosystem, particularly with the woodpeckers living just above in the trees?
Quality photos,
yeah.
of some of it.
Whoa, did you hear that?
Yeah, I did. So there's a lot that you and your team do so that the military can coexist and continue its training mission for readiness, preparedness to fight and win the nation's wars.
That's exactly right. Yeah, where our goal is, I mean, we know that we have endangered species. Our goal is to do proactive management that benefits those species such that we don't have to have any training restrictions.
I think people might have this impression of some poor, unfortunate creature wandering over a mine or happen to be in the spot where somebody's lobbing an artillery round.
Right. They envision a moonscape with craters from artillery and, you know, no trees because of all the frequent withering fire and stuff like that. But it's absolutely totally different. Military installations, if they have natural resources, have done a great job of managing that resource. If they have endangered species, of course, they're required to do that kind of work. And there are just success stories all across the country for our efforts to conserve endangered and threatened species under the Endangered Species Act.
We actually did a research project with the Construction and Engineering Research Lab, where we came out and did things like fire blank 50 caliber rounds near red-cockaded woodpecker nest trees. Now they do flush when that happens, but they always go right back to the cavity and start incubating or brooding their chicks again, and none of the nests that we did those experiments on failed because of that. They could have failed because of nest predation by flying squirrels or something else, but none of them appeared to fail because of noises. They seem to acclimate to it. Some of our most densely populated areas for the red-cockaded woodpecker occur downrange of the small arms ranges, so doesn't seem to bother them that much.
All day, we've seen and heard dozens of species of birds, but the changing of the land segues nicely into a discussion of Fort Stewart's indigenous reptiles. Two in the area that are listed include the eastern indigo snake and, in some parts of the country, the gopher tortoise.
Cottonmouth. That's a venomous snake. This is a very common snake on Fort Stewart.
Keep your distance. They can be, this species can be a little bit aggressive, but he's
probably a little bit cool right now.
So he might be a little sluggish this time of day?
Yeah.
Maybe this is a good segue into a conversation about the eastern indigo snake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll look at some of that kind of habitat. The eastern indigo snake is more associated with high, dry sand hills in the winter. They're also closely associated with gopher tortoise burrows in the winter. They use those as refuge because once you get down into the burrow, they have, you know, maintain a constant temperature, constant humidity. So it's kind of a nice place for a snake to overwinter so that it can escape those few cold days that we have, you know, in South Georgia. And it's the largest non-venomous snake in the country, in North America, as a matter of fact, with some of the adult males getting up to 7-8 feet long. And we have a pit tagging program where we insert a little tag in underneath the skin of the snake so we can scan them like you would scan something at a grocery store that can tell us when we recapture the snake, you know, when it was captured before, and we can remeasure the snake to see if it's growing and how far it's moved from one spot to the next. So they have pretty large ranges for a snake. The adult males at least, you know, cover about 4,000 hectares in their home range, which usually encompasses several territories of female eastern indigo snakes. So they make the rounds and try to breed as many of those females as they can.
Carlisle also manages the Department of Defense's REPI program for the installation. While we're driving, he takes a call.
He's our Georgia Alabama Land Trust partner, who is a lawyer, and he writes up the conservation easements that we do with neighboring landowners to protect their property from development. So he just told me that one property closed last week is about a 28-acre property southwest of the installation.
I'm going to have that one ready, hopefully today or tomorrow, for Fort Stewart to do its internal review on.
Okay.
So wanted to ask if you could send me a Amerdeck link to upload those files for review.
Yep, will do as soon as I get back to the office.
So this one's 112 acres and it adjoins, which is great. The one we just did, so kind of filling in that corridor.
Yeah, yeah, excellent.
It's a little bit further south, so we're sending you that MTP. So that's really the project updates I had for you.
All right. I did. That sounds good. I hope we can get it.
Okay. Yep, I just, all right, well, let me know if you need anything, and thank you.
All right, thank you, Hal. Yeah, so Fort Stewart itself is 278,000 acres and some change. It's the largest Army installation east of the Mississippi River. And REPI stands for Restoration and Environmental Protection Integration. So that is a DOD-wide program. One of the main goals is to reduce incompatible development on our boundary that may have a negative impact on the military mission. So, being the Army, we make a lot of noise with artillery and small arms weapons. We stir up a lot of dust with tanks running down these trails. We create a lot of smoke because of the prescribed fire program. And if you have a school or a housing development or condos or hospitals or, you know, a retirement community right on the boundary, that could have real impacts if you smoke in a site for a few days. So a lot of planning goes into when and where we burn to make sure that we don't dump our smoke on our neighbors, and limiting the development on our boundary makes that planning so much easier and allows us a little more flexibility to get areas burned when weather conditions permit.
Fort Stewart just hit a milestone with regard to the REPI program?
That's right, yeah. So as of this fiscal, quarter of this fiscal year, we've protected over 50,000 acres now that the Army has protected. There's also an additional approximately 20,000 acres that have been protected by other conservation organizations like Georgia DNR, the Conservation Fund, the Nature Conservancy, folks like that, who just coincidentally happened to protect the property within our REPI boundary, and we have a discrete boundary that we have to work within, right? We can't just start protecting property. It's got to be pertinent to our mission here. And then there's another about 18,000 acres in the Ogeechee River bottomland hardwoods that are not developable just because of their extensive wetlands. And so when you add all that acreage up, we've got about 90,000 acres around Fort Stewart that is permanently protected from incompatible development, which is great news. We've got a ways to go. We're about halfway to our goal.
The land of Fort Stewart is available for more than conservation, research, and military training. Carlisle's Fish and Wildlife Branch is the agency that manages the hunting and fishing program on the base, which is open to everyone. They want more soldiers and families stationed here to find ways to enjoy the land.
Because I was going to ask if citizens can drive out here if they're allowed to be out here.
Absolutely. This every installation is different, but many DOD installations provide an opportunity for outdoor recreations, not just for soldiers and their families, but for civilians too. And so there's methods by which you can do that. So on Fort Stewart, you would go to our Ice Sportsman website. You can purchase an access permit, so you can hunt or fish or hike or mountain bike or whatever sort of outdoor recreation it is that you would like to do. Consumptive stuff like hunting and fishing costs a little more than just say if you wanted to get a pass to Fort Stewart to go bird watching. So just a recreation pass with no hunting or fishing privileges is just $20. If you want to fish, that's a $50 pass, but that the $50 fishing permit allows you to do all the stuff that you could do just by buying a recreation permit also. And then if you wanted to hunt, that's an $80 permit. Or if you want a combination permit that allows you to hunt or fish or do anything else, it's like $130 for a civilian. And it's cheaper for soldiers. There's a sliding scale. If you're a E1 through E4, I think a combo permit is $45.
Thank you everyone for tuning in to the Marne Report. This has been Sergeant First Class Jason Hall, and I've been talking with Mr. Larry Carlisle, the Directorate of Public Works Fish and Wildlife Branch Chief. So I want to thank you, sir, for the tour and all the great information that we received today so that we can better appreciate and support our environmental responsibilities here on Fort Stewart and Hunter Army Airfield.
It's been my pleasure, Jason. I'd like to encourage folks who would like to experience the natural world of Fort Stewart firsthand to purchase an iSportsman permit on our Fort Stewart iSportsman website. Prices are reasonable for the kind of access you get, and you can see a lot of wonderful, beautiful nature at Fort Stewart. Thanks a lot.
This has been the Marne Report, Rock of the Marne.